Go to thecognitiverampage.com. Keep fueling the change. Help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support. Love you.
The Cognitive Rampage, a scientific approach to self-discovery, change, and life optimization, is now available on Amazon. What I do in the book is I fuse the latest research from the cognitive, behavioral, social, environmental, and biological sciences. It's not just motivational fluff and wordplay. Now, I do talk about my own story, so there's some kind of inspiration in there, but I'm not just spinning words and hyping you up with motivational fluff. Whether you need a life change, simply enjoy self-exploration and optimization, want to discover new hidden passions, or reduce the life-altering effects of toil, anxiety, depression, all of those issues, this book is for you. This book is not a cookie-cutter method of steps to follow. You'll customize the scientific framework with your own personal beliefs to build your authentic change. That way you assimilate it faster. It's not just copying my beliefs and telling you step one, step two. These will come from your beliefs as how you extend and build the foundation upon this framework. You'll use this framework throughout your whole life, through every change, and through every age. These are not empty words of motivational spin. This book is an experience. The Cognitive Rampage is based in science and is built from your beliefs. It's a path to help you unleash your desired change. You can apply this method on your own with no harmful side effects.
And welcome to the Cognitive Rampage podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your Cognitive Rampage. Oh, I'm excited today. You could even ask Patricia. For about a week or so, I've been walking around like, oh, I'm going to learn something. Anytime I get to have a guest of the caliber of Dr. Andrew Hill, I get excited like a kid before Christmas because I know some competence is coming, and I eat that up like it's a new bike and I'm eight. Joining me on the podcast, just for reference before we get to him, is Dr. Andrew Hill, who's been on the podcast before, been on Rogan, also has his own podcast, that was which I suggest you certainly tune into. I've been listening to it all week again. It is the Head First podcast, which you can find on iTunes and everywhere else. Dr. Andrew Hill is one of the top performance coaches in the country, holds a PhD in cognitive neuroscience from UCLA Department of Psychology, and continues to do research on attention and cognitive performance. The founder of Peak Brain Institute, like I said before, host of the Head First podcast, lectures at UCLA, teaching courses in psychology, neuroscience, and many more, and a lecture to come today. Welcome to the show, Dr. Andrew Hill.
Hey, thanks for having me again. I appreciate it. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, man. It's good to be able to reach out to you again. It's probably been about a year or so, yeah?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. Yeah, I'm always watching, seeing any guest that's ever come on the podcast. I stay following them, you know, the research, what they're doing now, you know, the podcast. I'd actually started listening to your podcast probably about 3 days after you put it out on iTunes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we dumped a whole bunch of shows. And as you know, it's a lot of work keeping one of those things going. So we've been on hiatus for a little bit. I think we have 14 or 15 shows out now. I have a couple new ones in the can, and we're going to be ramping that up again. I have somebody managing social media and podcasting and things for me now. So we'll be starting to crank on the content machine because, you know, we have this dual mission of both helping you take control of your own brain health individually, but also doing some evangelism around the things you can do in general around taking control of your brain health. So the podcast for us is more that latter educational and entertainment kind of mission that everyone can engage with healthy brain stuff. You don't have to, you know, be close to a peak brain, although you're welcome to come into peak brain as well.
Yeah. The competence alone on the first three episodes, much less the rest of them. I mean, I've listened to a few, over and over, but you know what? I could even pull it up now just so I remember the guest. Let's see. Well, I want to remember the guest, but of course it doesn't show up. Yep. It was episode 10, I believe. Let me see if I can find it up again. Yeah, of course it'll be that last name. Optimizing the Mind with Daniel. You're going to have to do this.
Schmachtenberger. Yeah, Daniel Schmachtenberger. He's one of the principals of the Neurohacker Collective, which is they produce the nootropic Qualia and a bunch of other projects they do. So yeah, really brilliant guy. That was one of the times in a podcast where I sort of, you know, had to hang on a little bit to the cognitive rampage that Daniel engages in. He's a powerhouse cognitively and verbally, and so it was a fun podcast to do with him.
Yeah, it's one of the ones also I saw you kind of, I don't know, you were geeking out yourself, man. You were meeting him halfway, yeah, but this, and then this, we see this. And I do that from time to time when I have a guest on that's talking about addiction or athletes, depression, mm-hmm. something like that. I start to geek out and go down that road. And, I mean, just the guest lineup that you have there where you talk about life extension, I mean, from brain imaging, how it even relates to nutrition. He mentioned things to do with posture and things that related to functioning.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, the biohacking space, you know, from the point of view of people like Daniel, even to me to some extent, you know, I helped design True Brain initially, which is another nootropic. You know, you'll think that this biohacking space is all about nootropics, but it's not. I mean, it really goes into every type of behavior you have control over that will impact your health. And it can get very high tech in the quantified self movement where you're tracking your heart rate and your sleep and everything else. Or it can be simply you're going to engage in a contemplative practice or daily exercise or something else that has the ability throughout the course of our lives to affect trajectories of growth and decline. And, you know, you really are in control of the trajectory, not if you grow or if you decline, but in the trajectory there. So if you want to flatten your trajectories later in life and sustain your resources, you can work counter as an individual against decline. But the goal is to work counter to the long-term declines you'll get between age 30 and, you know, 90 or so. If that trajectory is flat in bone mass and mostly muscle mass and cognitive health and speed of processing, working memory, then you're pretty much the same person in terms of young resources late in life as you are early. And that operates on a shorter time scale, day-to-day, moment-to-moment, as we're deciding to do things like get abs, or quit smoking, or whatever it is we're engaging with as a healthy habit. It has this trajectory, the whole arm that we actually are reaching in and controlling things. So we have to be aware of that and get a little more, you know, deterministic in our control, a little more voluntary in our control, I think.
Yeah, it's almost like the hunt for the perfect way to live life, right? It is adding extension or healthy along the way. And yeah. I kind of look at it from, you know, we may look at athletes, right, as peak performers, or and they may be at the precipice of what in shape means or being athletic means. But being an ex full-time athlete myself, I look at that on a long-term scale. And when that athlete turns 50, when that athlete turns 60, right, what are the implications of operating at that peak performance at that time versus, you know, like you mentioned, kind of this flat? I mean, what is the optimal way, if you will, to kind of live that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly peak athletes, so to speak, people, you know, who it's their calling, their vocation, it's something they're engaging in profoundly, and they're so the elites, the Ben Greenfield, these people who are really, you know, pushing themselves. That I would argue is a niche in terms of human performance, and not everyone can or needs to go there. You know, not everyone has that necessarily capability. I mean, you can get pretty close to a Ben Greenfield if you use all the same biohacking tools and approaches and diet and exercise that he do, or you can, you know, develop the same massive physique that you or I may have, you know, doing the same kinds of physical exercise. But it people are variable, and your performance peak is really specific to you. So athletes end up matching that performance to the sport or to the specific goal, the specific thing they're doing. And that is where the question about cost versus benefits come in, because let's say you're one of the best fencers in the world. Okay, you have cardiovascular health and profound leg strength and ridiculous reaction times and wrists of steel. Probably not a huge amount of negative impact on your long-term health. Maybe your knees wear out faster and you have some knee replacements later on in life or something. Football player, NFL player, well, okay, 5-10 years of NFL, now you have CTE damage to your brain. I mean, even high schoolers are showing CTE type changes in their brain at this point. There's certain types of rigorous activity that is not safe. Sadly, head impact is one of those activities. So if you take head impact out of a game, like if you talk about things that include head impact or include body, a core sort of things, then I think we're all right. If basketball players do get elbows, but it's not necessarily part of the game the same way that, you know, hitting a 300-pound guy with your 300 pounds is in football. So we have to, I think talk about what the physical rigor is, but this, it's the same thing. Those guys in the NFL or you know, big guys who are playing those big body sports, so to speak. I would include things like rugby and other, you know, big, where you're throwing yourself at other people's stuff. You're building the body that can do that with consequence later to your brain, to your, you know, joints. But you take gymnasts, profoundly, you know, elite gymnasts, and all the ones that I know who are 40 and 50 have wrecked shoulders and destroyed elbows and wrists that, you know, they can barely use a mouse, some of them, because they have like accelerated, you know, sort of repetitive damage and things. I don't know. I mean, what's your goal? Is your goal to be one of the top 10 gymnasts in the world? Maybe it's worth it. We are developing the ability to remediate and rehabilitate a lot of things. So there was a couple studies last year showing that even knee tissue that's where the tendons have completely parted, if you give stem cells, there's some percentage of complete regrowth where the knee knows how to knit itself back together. We didn't know this until last year, year before. We're discovering that the brain is making new neurons your entire life all over the place, not just a few places, but a bunch of places. So the plasticity question is a little more open-ended than we thought it was. You know, getting back to the idea of trajectories, if you hit 50 or 60 at good health, there's a really good indication of long-term survival into oldest old, you know, 65 and above. And that is the age, the body composition that you go into age 60 at, and then the change at 70. If that's flat, you're pretty much going to live the rest of your life healthy, and probably it's going to be a long life. So that keeping that thing set, you know, if you're a little overweight going into 60, but you're a really, you know, massive ex football player or something, and you keep that muscle mass, that bone mass at 70, for whatever your physical exercise and activity and diet and genes, if you keep things stable, that's beautiful. Now, 30 is when all this stuff starts to decline. Sarcopenia. At 30, we get sort of irreversible at a population level decline in muscle mass, skeletal mass, water mass, but an you can work against these things and build all these tissues in the right direction. But again, stability and control over the resources and some sense of action as you live your life and you can take control of your bodies, I think what's important. And it, again, if you want to be one of those elite performers, you can be a Ben Greenfield. You know, you can go do Ironmans and other, you know, really high-end elite events and train your body and run marathons. I have my little sister, 5 foot tall, 90 pounds, runs marathons. And she's been doing it for like 30 years or something ridiculous. I would go run a marathon or any running. I ran in high school. I'm built not like a runner. I'm built like a shot putter or something. And so I would try to sprint and do running and end up like injured with knee and shin. And I'm just not physiologically built for it. Could I have learned to be a physical tweaking, biomechanics? But was it a goal for me? No. So I went and pole vaulted, you know, and did other things where the power played to my strengths in the track, you know, arena, so to speak. So.
Well, that's so much, man. Where does the brain kind of play in into its development or the implication of maybe those physical talents, if you will, right? That makeup of who we are, what we want to be, or where does that cross over into the belief? How does that, you know, you open up a wormhole for me, man.
Yeah. So that question's a lot. That's a good question. There's a lot there too, though. I would say, you know, you think about traits and resources that are built in. You think about things you build on top of those base tendencies that may be well allocated or not well allocated, because the whole system is changeable in terms of the brain. You'll also think about some things that are more human. I mean, what you're asking about to some extent is, can I focus? Can I drive? Can I get things done? You're also asking about personality traits, conscientiousness, you know, agreeableness, neuroticism, those kind of things. And there's some evidence that the higher level personality traits, the interpersonal stuff to some extent, how we take care of the world and each other, doesn't change all that much. And that seems to be, at least the thermostats are set towards certain biases. And we change a little bit as we learn, does seem to be, you know, pretty good. But those some biases in how agreeable, how, you know, open, how neurotic you are, seems to be kind of a little set point and some traits in your personality. Very gross, very broad, very 10,000 foot, you know, sense. But there's something there, and you shift a little bit as you go through adolescence and adulthood and develop more responsibility and learn to take care of other people. There's some shifts in that. mostly women get a little more agreeable and less neurotic, and men, not much gets much better. You know, we get a little more responsible basically, but men are, you know, basically pretty stable throughout life. Women continue to learn and improve a little more than men do, it looks like, across some of the personality traits, but it's not a huge feature. They're pretty stable. Brain resources, big factor. So
what do you mean by when you say brain resources?
Brain resources, there's a couple of things I consider to be valid descriptions of human performance resources that dip one level below something like intelligence. I mean, intelligence is what an intelligence test measures. It's an invalid concept scientifically. It's got cultural biases. It's got political biases. There's different versions of it that really emphasize and de-emphasize different things. So it's a scientific tool of investigation. It's not an individual person level assessment. It may be a statistical population level valid tool, but for looking at your intelligence, it's just not, I don't think, a valid thing. It does correlate with some things, but if you look at all the sub resources within an intelligence test, you end up with a couple of convergent sort of views on what the big holy grails of human performance, the big resource limits or bottlenecks or sources of power, if you will, that will be required by other things we do. And those include working is another really big resource. And working memory and speed of processing are really both very highly correlated with intelligence, but they're also...
And easily break. I mean, if I'm relying on my memory as one of my power sources, then I haven't... I don't know. Do we have an unreliable memory function in there?
Well, working memory, not storage memory, not recall. So working memory is like the RAM in your brain. It's the amount of... or the desktop. It's the amount of things you can have open at once before stuff gets kicked out. Humans can have 5 to 9 items, 7 ± 2 roughly in their brain. And if your working memory is 7 items, you're typical. And if it goes up by a point, you're about a standard deviation above average in a lot of other resources like intelligence. And as it dips, you have profound challenges. And part of it is the amount of things you can hold in your mind. And part of it is your inhibitory tone. Can you control what comes in and out of your mind? You could have the ability to see 10 things at once, but if you're really ADHD and a different 10 things keeps coming in and knocking stuff out of your awareness, you can't hold a thought. You can't develop a complex progressive relationship with information. You can't get tasks done. So the speed of processing is how fast you get there, how quickly you shift out of gear, how quickly you use that information. Speed of processing tends to be inversely correlated with things like inhibition. So you can have people who are very, very quick, but that might be impulsive or anxious. So there's sort of the sweet spot, like many things in brain resource, of getting just fast enough to engage with the stressors you're experiencing, but then, you know, have a resilient, flexible response to those resources being engaged, not work at the edge of your resources so that things are brittle and they fall over when things get a little bit out of your control. So brain resources in terms of development across time include things like myelination of the tissue, wrapping it in insulation. And that increases your whole life. But it sort of hits kind of near its maximum and then slows down in your early 20s, let's say. Maybe a little before that. And then in your early 20s, just after that, you develop inhibitory neurons that actually slow the brain down a little bit, give you self-control. You develop more brakes in the prefrontal cortex from late teens to early 20s, that's when most of the inhibitory neurons are really set up there. So you don't have full self-control until about age 24, 25.
I knew it.
Yeah. I mean, some of us never fully get that, you know, good inhibitory tone, especially for a hunter or, you know, driven brain or ADHD or have a lot of trauma that's taught our brain to be this, you know, over our life. So the myelination happens, brainwaves speed up, speed of processing speeds up, and we develop more in plateaus around early 20s, and then things are pretty much stable, and myelination continues to improve a little bit, and cell bodies, when that sarcopenia kicks in at 30, you start losing some brain tissue, especially if you aren't using it, but not the same way you do. It's like it's a fraction of a percent, like 0.5% or less a year after age 65 or something. So it's pretty stable, and then it starts to dip after age 60, 65. You lose some cell bodies, but myelination's still increasing. So at some point, the loss in cell bodies slows down the brain again. You have a drop in speed of processing, and that's when elders, people between ages 58 and about 65 or 68, will often start to notice slowed processing, and their experience of it is word-finding difficulty, or silly short-term memory. Like we were just talking about what was that? But it's not actually a true memory issue. It's just not encoding things fully because you aren't really your mind's a tiny bit drifty, tiny bit slow. And so in terms of recall, like word finding, you can't grab words out of your brain quickly enough because the machinery is lagging. And in terms of short-term memory, your attention's lagging, so stuff's kind of bouncing off and then isn't there a second later. So it's like grandma's getting a little blank here and there and can't find words. It may not be anything major at all. Maybe normal, typical, slight slowed speed of processing, you know? And those sorts of things are, again, not a problem usually. And they're a little frustrating, but not usually a sign of an injury or illness. There's just a normal problem. And they're ameliorable. You can change them. They're tractable to things like meditation, neurofeedback, nootropics. So you can actually address a lot of exercise. You can address the speed of processing stuff and the working memory, the control, the inhibitory control of working memory through lots of ways.
So, I mean, there's at least three things there. So I'm picking up that we can actually keep our brain fed, if you will, if not regenerate dying cells, which we know the brain regenerates itself. So, I mean, I'm comparing this to the thoughts of diseases where they're calling addiction a disease or any other brain, if you will, in quotes, and linking these ideas or then almost unraveling or disproving those ideas.
Well, I mean, when you talk about the brain, so much saying anything is true is hard because we don't know a lot. But that being said, saying anything is fixed, meaning not changeable, that's bogus. I mean, that's utter absurdity. The brain's whole damn job is to shift. Shift happens. Its job is to maximize our appreciation of gain, to get some, and to minimize the exposure to pain and suffering and reduce the chances our genes won't get passed on. That's the drive, you know, the hypothalamus, the four Fs, feeding, fleeing, fighting, sex. That's the motivated behavior center. And that's largely about why we live as animals, right? And the human stuff's a little bit above that.
You caught me on some. Elon actually said it on Joe's podcast the other day about the limbic brain system. The primal is what you're discussing there. Was actually in control of the cerebral cortex, of the thoughts, the human rationalization and thinking. I took it back twice and I re-listened to it. And I'm having a little brain freak out here for a minute.
Yeah, I really respect Elon's focus on cars and spaceships and view about the future. I don't usually agree with anything he says about the brain, including brain-computer interfaces, including AI. I really don't agree with anything he says, honestly. I'm pretty much in an orthogonal camp. I just think he's kind of off base. The limbic system is the Pape circuit, hippocampus, amygdala, hypothalamus in some models. Is about learning to a large extent. Hippocampus, these seahorse shaped structures in the thumb, in the temporal lobe, amygdala sits in the front of them, which is tagging fear and threat based things into our memory. Goes into the hypothalamus, which is that motivated behavior thing I mentioned. So about learning where the yummy food is, where the hot person is, where the dangerous tiger is. That's where the deep things. But humans are not necessarily driven by drives the same way that someone without a dramatically developed cortex, because the cortex's job, the top of the brain's job, is to, at least the prefrontal cortex, the most human part, is to say no. Those prefrontal inhibitory neurons I mentioned do their job the way most CEOs do in a Western company. Don't do that. Don't sell that. Don't bring that product out yet. They're coordinating everyone's all the individual departments pressure. The marketing guy wants to get all the copy out. The sales guy wants to discount. The engineer wants to push the next iterations or solve this bug. Everyone has their own motivation. The mailroom guy wants to get his information in and out. The company has to be driven by somebody. So the PFC does that by usually saying, hold your horses. Okay, now. Not yet. And when this guy's underactive, you get sensory systems driving, which can happen in a couple of ways. One is if this is just not quite as active as it maybe wants to be by default, and you get ADHD. So, you know, sensory systems drive sensory acquisition. Ooh, what is that? Ooh, squirrel. You know, ooh, novelty. But there's some evolutionary benefit to that, to have a brain tuned that way. So you notice the hard to spot berry someone else couldn't see, the tiger first, you know, the guy about to creep up behind you. you know, the information processing, good novelty seeking, synthetic, pattern matching kind of brain, the ADHD brain, if you will, is a hunter, is the synthetic, aware, up, very resource ADHD can play video games for 47 and a half hours without a break, right? But they can't do 47 minutes in a quiet meeting. So it's not a question of resources. And some people are built to have these resources tuned a little more one way. Getting back to your idea of disease, a lot of these things are learning. When the brain is, it's a changing machine, it's a changeable machine. Yeah, addiction, it socially is a disease. Neuroscientifically, medically, it's learning. Unless you consider how the social medical piece, but it's learning, you know. And yes, maybe your mu opioid receptors are of a certain flavor, so alcohol is extra yummy to you. That's true. That happens. That happens in a small percentage of people. I forget if it's 20% or 30%. It's some percentage. And yeah, it may make alcohol a little more interesting. But we can get addicted to television, sex, food, non-physiologically dependence-creating drugs like cannabis, you know, can have an addictive behavioral quality. I'm making the distinction because I would consider addiction to be, strictly speaking, to require tolerance and dependence. And I would argue that while you get tolerance to things like cannabis, you don't get dependence. You know, at most, your sleep gets irritated and you're a little bit, you know, not that interested in eating and your mood's a bit low for a few days. For the vast majority of people who are hardcore cannabis users, they could stop cold and they wouldn't actually have any consequence. So there's no real dependence. There is tolerance. So I don't consider something like that, you know, an addictive substance physiologically.
Yeah, I didn't mean to stop the cognitive rampage there, man.
No worries.
I'm going all the way back to where we're talking about brain resources, even how it walked us all the way down here and how you're explaining that. And you're basically studying brain images, right? Over time of various individuals, a lot of individuals, and then making those comparisons. And basically everything you're talking about here is coming from a lot of imaging and research imaging, things like that.
Yeah. I work in EEG, brainwaves. And so there's a few different ways you can use brainwaves, and some are more research and some are more clinical driven. Sleep studies are all EEG driven typically to look if you have apnea, if you're waking up, and that's usually an EEG sort of landscape. In the cognitive neuroscience, we use ERPs, little evoked potentials, little blips that happen when the brain does an information event. And you can sort of gauge how your brain processes information by looking at little blips with repeated trials of the same behavior and get a sense of how your brain performs. There's a waveform called the P300, positive wave at 300 milliseconds after you notice something you want to notice. And as you get older, the P300 drops in amplitude and gets slower in latency because you have fewer cells producing it. So you can gauge the amount of attention resources you can bring online by looking at the size of the P300 or something. But it's an investigation tool, a research tool.
Yeah, or any of those, the brain imaging, right?
Those can be, because you can look at where, what tissue is producing that can be very informative. You know, as you get older, again, I'm a gerontologist, so I often bring things back to an aging perspective. As you get older, the attention resource that blips, the P300, moves back in the brain, becomes less of a cognitive resource. But most of what I do for imaging, if you will, and it's not exactly neuroimaging, it's a statistical analysis, is we do EEGs, quantitative EEGs, and we can get you into one of our offices at some point, Adam, and do your QEEG. And to get one of these, you put a cap on your head, squirt it full of gel, get about 21 channels of data of resting baselines, eyes closed and eyes open for several minutes each. And we take that resting baseline scalp activity, the EEGs, and we compare it to a database of other people who are your age, essentially, and get out of that a set of Z-scores or standard deviation heat maps that tell me how unusual a couple hundred parameters in your brain are from the average person your age. And this doesn't give us a diagnostically sort of valid, oh, this is true. What it gives us is a set of hypotheses, because the patterns that are showing up are you compared to a population of people, and therefore the patterns that are showing up are valid at a population level, like 10,000 foot view level. Some of the patterns are extremely valid for individuals. Like if I see patterns related to ADHD or other executive function difficulty, which is usually high theta brainwaves relative to low beta, high theta beta ratio. And if your theta beta ratio at rest is high with your eyes open, I would go, oh, this is likely an ADHD pattern. That discriminant is valid, I think 94, 95% accurate or something. Very, you know, pretty reliable. There's a handful of other ones that are also quite reliable and usually show up the way that I expect, but it is that is really lit up. It usually means a little bit of either PTSD or kind of a learning system that's learned the world isn't safe, is evaluating the world all the time. And that may verge into actually, you know, capital letters, PTSD, or it may just be that hot resource. You're the guy that sits with your back to the door. Or if I see an anterior cingulate hotspot in beta, maybe it's OCD, the behavior and thoughts really spinning. Or maybe it's not that bad. Maybe it's songs getting stuck in your head and it's annoying. Or maybe you're a CEO who uses that hyperfocus all the time every day and it's not a problem for you. So we see resources that are unusual in your brain and then use those with your aid to understand what the bottlenecks might be for you, like i.e. what's valid, and then B, what's important? What do you want to work on? What do you want to take control over? So this is closer to watching it walk into a gym and saying, I want abs, than it is walking to a doctor's office and saying, help.
Well, I love it because you're looking at the functioning here where you could actually get a study and be looked at to say that, all right, this is functioning well for you. I mean, talk about a brain resume. You know what I mean? It's almost like what you're building. I'm talking about cognitive performance and linking those. But the question I got to bring it up is, you know, is the environment that we've been exposed to creating how our brain is functioning per se, or is our brain born to function away?
Great question. Generally in brain stuff, both in basic resources and in the overall trajectory across life, the aging, the development of those resources and how they can unfold. About a third of the equation is genetic, is built in. And about two thirds of it is how your brain learns and evolves and adapts and, you know, adjusts to the environment. And not all of how you adjust the environment is driven by the environment. Some of it's driven by how you deal with stuff. So you can have two people who go through very similar experiences that are ordeals, and one person emerges from that with a system that is, you know, a little OCD or PTSD or something, and someone else emerges from that with profound skills of remaining absolutely calm in a crisis. You know, it may be because somebody had a set point or an irritability of their amygdala that was a little different or something else, but I mean, the more we talk about what could be going on deeply in the brain, how these things work, oh, it's my amygdala, oh, it's my dopamine, the more we're specific, the less we're accurate here. We really don't know much about the brain. And so it's useful to go, what is some interesting information? And does that tell me things I can act on? And does it change when I do things that make change subjectively? I mean, I do a map of your brain, it gives you some patterns. We may be able to together understand which ones are really interesting, really useful, describe this resource, that resource, but then we exercise those patterns a few times a week, and every 20, 25 sessions, you make about a standard deviation of change. So huge change. We can usually take profound ADHD and just, you know, train it away in 3 or 4 months, so 40, 50 sessions of training, and it's usually gone. Or seizure disorders get suppressed dramatically, migraines get re-regulated, anxiety, PTSD, as well as things like creativity, or speeding up that slowed processing that isn't a problem in aging, but it's kind of annoying, to get your word finding back, or, you know, do deep creativity work or deep immune system work or access consciousness work before you're going out in your big, you know, creative thing or your athletic thing. You can do deep access work by reaching in and turning on brainwaves to put you into that hypnagogic creative state or that focused state, or tune down the tendency to go squirrel, or tune down the tendency to go, oh my God, the world sucks, if you don't think it's working for you. But it's cosmetic almost. You get control over it and you can evaluate what works.
That's what I'm looking at the brain, the way you're talking. I'm going, this is this endless thing with plasticity that I can move and bend and shape, given if I'm, you know, want to try a new experience, try something I don't know, try something I do know over and over to master that something. Yeah. Almost that we can change the brain when we take in behavior, environment, how we process the thought, how we respond to those thoughts, repeated behavior, essentially. I mean, we're looking, it gets so complex, man. I mean, how does one specialty ever going to be able to tell that it's this way? I mean, I see specialists that fight against other specialists. And the more I'm looking at this, is all of these specialists are, well, a special part in how it all works.
Yeah. I think that specialists and people with specific ideas, that's, I mean, what did Maslow say? To a man with a hammer, every problem is a nail. And I'm guilty of this. You know, my hammer, my lens is the QEEG, my tool sets, neurofeedback, mindfulness, heart rate variability, that kind of stuff. But, you know, you and I both, we have a fitness perspective to some extent on how this system works. And when you think about that, you can not have to be specific. I'm not treating someone's anxiety. You come in and say, hey, my stress response is a little awry. At least that's what I'll hear if you say things that mean anxiety. And then together we go, is this what it is in your brain? Let's see.
Wow.
So you have control over the process, and it's no longer me doing things to you. It's you taking agency the same way you would if you went and did a full body fit scan. Well, oh, I got a torn left shoulder. My left side of my lower body's a little bit strong. My right side should balance that out. And, you know, you could really dial in the machine here and take control. It's the agency perspective that you're getting lit up by, I think. You actually have control over it.
That's hope is what that is, right? That's for somebody, that's hope, other than saying, hey, you have a disease, you're screwed for life, it's autoimmune, it's genetic, et cetera. For so many people, what you're really saying by being able to observe the ability to change it, to modify it, to have control over it, and once you start working in, whether it's neurotropics or, God, I mean, maybe even walk us further in, man, on how neurotropics play into that, and yeah. How that also links to stem cells. I had a Dr. Van Thiessen on here who talked a lot about it as well. Kind of walk in through, you know, that hope, really. Expand on that hope idea that it's modified, it's changeable, whether it may be autoimmune or genetically passed down. Are we genetically screwed? You know, or does autoimmune essentially really mean that it's over and cells just die? Can we, I'm hearing hope with the study.
Yeah, right? There should be hope. I mean, genetics is a little complicated, obviously, but I will say that most things that are genetic are not Mendelian. They aren't dominant recessive. I mean, even things like eye color probably aren't. I have some, you know, recessive genes and things. Most things aren't that two copies producing the experience in your resources, the phenotype. A few things are. I mean, if one of your parents has Huntington's, you get a 50% chance. And if you get it in current medicine, current modification, current lifestyle, there's not a whole lot you can do. You probably will start to die at around age 35 or 40, and, you know, it'll be a decline of motor control and cognition, and it will take, you know, some time. It will not be treatable. But most things aren't like that. Most things aren't a switch that's flipped and, oh, okay. I mean, some things are. You know, you have the worst breast cancer gene. It's like a 44% increased risk or something. It's massive increased risk. But most things aren't. Most things are subtle. And it's kind of like having a long stream where there's many, many, many upstream things being dumped in, and the accumulation is the effect you get way downstream. But they're all very subtle effects. So you can control, even if the stream's flowing completely the wrong direction, you can intervene in, let's say you have some broken things in your brain. You don't make neurotransmitters the way most people do. You don't methylate, let's say. You got some problem in your dopamine turnover genes, your amine turnover genes, which means you probably have some, if you're lucky, ADHD, if you're not lucky, schizophrenia, you know, maybe something else, maybe some OCD, who knows, something about learning and reinforcement.
Can you throw CTE or something like that in there as you're talking about it?
I'm sorry?
Could you throw maybe CTE? I was throwing something like that in there as being something that's regressive or not.
Yeah, I mean, CTE wouldn't be genetically predisposed to. You know, that's really just an injury. Yeah. But in terms of, like, you could see some things genetically, like a neurotransmitter methylation pathway, and you can address it. You can go, oh, my dopamine isn't turned back over into dopamine again. Let me add some of the right methyl B12, whatever, and okay, now I'm, you know, lubricating that system. Or you can go, you know, I have some issues with word finding, you know, the speed of processing thing, and then you find some paracetam. As the, you know, poster child nootropic, it tends to add verbal fluency and speed up verbal access a little bit. So it's a fairly innocuous substance, and you can play with these things and add these things in. But again, it becomes about this idea of you do have control. I will say one thing about nootropics. I think people are often getting into trouble. I think, you know, elders get in trouble who hear about them and go after these things. I think that young, hot people looking for the next big edge get in trouble because they go after dangerous research chemicals, things that aren't really nootropics, that are more addictive substances, or just off-label drugs that have a few downsides. And I think you have to, if you're a biohacker, if you're somebody who's trying to improve your cognition, not treat a problem, but really take the system up in resources, you have a responsibility to be very careful and not experiment with things with any significant downside. And the true definition of nootropic are things that improve cognition, memory, aging without much in the way of downside, no true side effects. So I think it's important that if you're in that, I'm going to take control of the system, you do so without going after the things that are dangerous, you know, without going after prescription drugs or, you know, stimulant class things or, you know, research chemicals from unknown sources, because you can get into trouble. You can get significant side effects. So that being said, you can dial in the right solution for you and it can be rather magical. I do think you should work on the foundation things first. You should hack your sleep, get it sorted out, your nutrition, your exercise, your contemplative practice, your meditation, prayer, whatever it is for you. I think all these things need to be dialed in because they're all different resources that are foundational. And then the experience of human performance, cognition, is on top of those resources. So get the resources sorted out. You go to the gym, most people, not to look like you went to the gym, but to have good health and wellness and maybe to be good at your sport or good in bed or good at your stressful job or whatever it is. But you go and exercise the body to use the body better later. And you can do that to the complete system, including the central nervous system. And there's lots of ways to dial it in. So I think you should look at foundational things. You should be hacking your sleep, meditating, dialing in a brain healthy diet, anti-aging diet, which is usually high fat, medium protein, low carb, and then you know, dial in other things if you need to. Take nootropics in after that to kind of take things up another level after the foundation is sorted. If you got some deficit that isn't moving how you want fast enough, neurofeedback becomes a big heavy lifter to just take a resource and go, nope, I'd rather not be ADHD right now, thank you. Or this OCD is getting my way, let me really, you know, use a big gun. Then neurofeedback becomes a quick tool because it's a few months to make a big brain change. Otherwise, excuse me, otherwise mindfulness or meditation or some other kind of practice can drag around. UCLA, who talks about using mindfulness to get rid of OCD, which normally you would think meditation and anxiety stuff, or, you know, it's in conflict. You wouldn't want to activate anxiety by meditating, but there's a directed mindfulness way to break OCD compulsions that Dr. Schwartz has figured out and uses therapeutically. So you can use lots of tools. You have agency. You can use cheap and free tools. Meditation doesn't cost anything. Go to peakbraininstitute.com's website. There's a free meditation tutorial, 20-minute practice. Do it every day. Cut it in half if it sounds threatening. 10 minutes every morning. A couple of weeks in, you'll be different. Things will change. Things will start to change.
Yeah, I've always said since I got into psychology a long time ago that I thought that neuroscience was the future, would hold the answers, if not the revealing of functioning and how that happens, you know. And I often wonder how much, and I mean, I know how much, but maybe to a scientific degree, how much social constructs per se, and who we're supposed to be, things like that, and how they play into the thoughts we think we have that are our own original thoughts, you know, and how we look at brain functioning to where we look at it as a whole, that so many people's brain functions differently. I start to see all these different beautiful people, but then when we have to take, say, this ADHD brain, right, yeah, this brain that functions in a way, and look at it as either a diagnosis, right, this negative connotation of diagnosis, because it doesn't fit into our social construct square. The seven-year-old doesn't sit still, therefore he has this negative construct upon him. And I don't know, I think we're missing so many beautiful people.
I think you're right. I think there's two things there. One is you have to draw a line to some extent between things that are just normal spectrum of human behavior that can get dysregulated, like ADHD. Being impulsive doesn't mean ADHD. Being anxious doesn't mean an anxiety disorder. You know, you're being chased by a tiger, be anxious. Good for you. It's exactly the right thing to do. Yeah. But when you're sitting in traffic and someone lays on the horn, you don't want to react like it's a tiger.
Yeah.
And so it's impulsive. If you always need the high stimulus to engage, if you can never disengage, that's a problem. So, you know, you think about the resources, ADHD, okay, we shouldn't have to pathologize it because those people have some nice skills sometimes, you know, in terms of athletic performance, pattern matching, creativity, but there's also some downsides potentially, right? The other piece of it is some things are getting in the way. You know, if you're schizophrenic and you can't compensate, you can't wash yourself, shop, you know, pay your rent, it's a problem. So a lot of the psychological perspective, not the neuroscience, but the psychological perspective would define disorder essentially broadly as things, X, Y, and Z symptoms, but always as getting in the way in your life, in usually two aspects, at least two aspects of your life before it's truly a thing. So it has to impair social function, work function, academic function, some other kind of function. You know, these things have to actually make it so you're not able to interact with typical human society in a way that's going to keep you safe and keep other people safe. And that's a pretty broad, you know, threshold to set, but it's a pretty safe one to set. The only problem is it is still graded or gauged based on the average human agreed upon societal construct, human resource. So you're right. It does still gauge people as where unusual is atypical, but only if they can't pass. You can be completely batshit crazy, but if you can sit there and do a podcast and attract ad dollars and, you know, inspire people to do shit, great. You know, you have total control over your resources. But if you can't go out and if you can't go and put gas in your car, you know, it's a problem. So I would say be crazy as you can get away with if it doesn't get in the way, you know, of your life. And if it gets in the way of your life, it may mean you need to change your crazy a little bit, change your resources, get control over your resources. It may mean you need to change your life. Maybe you should just go look, you know, construct a life where you can be as crazy as you want to be.
Yeah. I mean, I point out a lot that, you know, the symptoms are what I would consider our diagnoses. You know, if you're diagnosed depression, anxiety, to me, these are symptoms. And when I hear people treating them in some dangerous ways, I'm going, you're treating the symptom, right? I mean, what we're talking about here, even from your aspect, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is in the brain development as being kind of the quarterbacking of everything that's going on. It's also the seed that we cultivate, that we help, that we expose it to, that what we're putting, the environments we put ourselves in, affect the way that seed is going to grow, even though that seed is also the quarterback of things that are happening.
Yeah, you're right. So if under resourced in development, you don't scaffold enough development to get out of your own way, and so you end up with the bad brain resources and bad behavior and weird learning and anxiety and violence and, you know, all kinds of things. If you feed a kid horrible food or no food, you know, tape his eyes shut, the brain can develop awry, and some things are hard to develop out of. Language. If you didn't have language until age 10 or 11, you would never develop language properly. Wouldn't happen. Your brain stops developing language about age 10. It's in terms of true deep language. Vision has to be developed by age 6 months or so in terms of visual fusion and getting the eyes together, or the brain's a really hard time. The critical period for development is over for a few of these big resources. This is why you can't learn a new language without an accent after age 10 or 11, because because stuff is stuck now. It's shut down. It's done being super plastic.
Many impressions, and now it's stuck, and it has to sound like that too.
That's right. And then, you know, other languages, once you're 11, 12, go on the opposite side to some extent. So you end up with like distributed languages. Unless you heard languages that weren't yours before you were age 10 or 11, the brain then will remember those phonemes. That's right. Those sounds exist. But anything you didn't hear before age 10, you basically can't hear in terms of a speech sound afterwards. So, you know, we have control over it, but some things are critical periods. Some things are bound like that. Most things aren't. Most things are the brain continually changing and adapting itself to everything. This is why you can learn, why you can control behavior, why you can do therapy. I mean, therapy is the deep systems learning, not the cortex as much, but it's more the things, you know, Elon was talking about, the limbic system learning to some extent, or at least it's taking cognitive experience that has limbic entanglement, shall we say, and it's giving you a safer way to experience it, because having a memory, it's kind of like taking the memory off a shelf, unremembering it, and then putting it back on the shelf and restoring it. So if you do that in therapy in a safe context, or if you do that with a beta blocker in your system so you can't have an emotional reaction, the memory comes out, goes back in, and its teeth are pulled. This is why therapy works for trauma to some extent.
Yeah,
so
EMDR therapy, some of the intense therapies, revisiting those scenes and coming back out and trying to deneutralize or downplay the intensity of it.
They are, but a lot of the physiological mechanism of that is activating the posterior temporal lobes, where there's often sort of, you know, some trauma formation in some way. And you can do that in EMDR with a therapeutic context. It looks like EMDR works without the eye movements with a good therapist, even. It's interesting. It looks like you can cause the same brain signature of EMDR using really slow neurofeedback. There's some slow cortical potential training on the posterior temporal lobes. You can activate that same kind of plasticity. But it's a plasticity thing we're activating somehow when you do like an EMDR.
Literally undoing the trauma experience, well, at least with how the brain developed because
of the unsticking. You're unsticking the patterns.
Okay. All right.
So then they can shift a little bit and learn differently. Because learning is laid down. The more you learn, the deeper that trough gets. You know, neurons that wire together, fire together, wire together. The more they fire together, the more tightly they wire together, to the point where one always has to fire when the other one is being fired. So that's a really tight learning when the synapses are really tied together, really, really tightly coupled. But you can, all learning can change. So you have to learn away from that. And some of these things like EMDR, like beta blockers, like ECT, like microdosing, like neurofeedback, like meditation, like exercise, cause a boost in plasticity in these temporal lobe structures. And so they unstick and they're able to be changed better, faster, more reliably. So yeah, again, we're back to agency. You have control over almost all of this stuff. Even though it doesn't usually feel like it in the moment, you can do things to take control of the directions it will develop, change, grow, age, et cetera.
Yeah. So what's the 10-year from now idea in brain imaging scanning? What's the goal? What's the, as a whole, because you're on the forefront, man. You're in the trenches of this, well, a few specialties, really, but really encompassing the brain, how it functions, how it, you know, could affect, and reading those things. What's the 10 years out now and how that may play into mental health, how we function as individuals, how we diagnose those things?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm not sure. I think that one of the biggest inflections we're going to see sort of socioculturally in terms of how it affects neuroscience and health and medicine is quantified self meets electronic health records, where everyone is tracking their own sleep, stress, exercise, diet. And it's not just you're tracking those things like we did in a fitness app 10 years ago, where you have your personal records and your carbs, your macros and all those things. It's not going to be like, oh, here's my methylation status and this is changing. All these really subtle things on your app, and your doctor becomes your coach with an eye on your fluctuating things. Right now we have the ability to cure many diseases that we can't or don't in individuals because we don't discover them fast enough. If we discover you have pancreatic or stomach cancer and you've had it for 60 days, guess what? Unfortunately, you probably don't have very long to live. And a few other things. Breast cancer discovered in the first couple of stages is very, very, very treatable. You know, prostate cancer, when it's aggressive, it's rarely aggressive for men. Most men die with, not from prostate cancer. But if you have one of those rare forms, it's aggressive, and you catch it, okay, you can treat it. So having the quantified self tied in better, so we don't have to type in our data and measure our pulse and do those sorts of things. So having the body system feed into our quantified self infrastructure, and having our medical professionals, our coaches, our priests, our shamans, our nutritionists, our yoga teachers have a sense of what all of this stuff is doing and being our partners and helping control it and maximize. Just like, you know, I wouldn't go if I was going to become an Olympic weightlifter. I could go weightlift. I could do it in my garage, but I probably get a whole lot more out of it working with somebody who's taught people how to do this and taught their bodies how to do it in a really efficient, powerful way. So we're going to have people in that role whose job it is to come in and help you demystify this stuff, learn what's best to track. Right now, it's a bit of a wild mapping with attention testing of what the data actually is. It's not, you know, it's not exactly like going for a blood test and saying, oh, my testosterone's too low. But it's almost like that. And it's better because we don't draw blood, but also because the data is this really stable measure that doesn't change rapidly in brain mapping anyways. So you get to see it change. If you do anything to your brain and you get a change in your brain rapidly, you know it's from the thing you just did to your brain. So you can be like, I'm going to go hardcore keto for 3 weeks and see what does to my seizures. And you can see it in your brain activity. So it's a really nice way to get the agency, you know?
Yeah, I always saw that and still see it as really the future of diagnosing. And once you started bringing stem cells, changing these things, I do see it as the most fascinating science. That's the new horizon in mental health to me is what we're going to learn from. You know, we need more studies and these things putting together. But it takes that personal diagnosis away. It takes this I'm just a bad person. I have bad genetics, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I look at someone's brain and I'm like, oh, here's this thing. And they're like, oh my gosh. Oh yeah. It wants to notice everything, but can't only notice one thing. Oh gosh. Yes. It's my brain. It's like looking at your shoulder x-ray and going, oh, broken shoulder or separated shoulder. You don't feel guilty about your shoulder having an injury. You don't feel, you know, guilty about your brain having an OCD pattern or a PTSD pattern. It makes sense suddenly. And then you can decide what to do about it, because if it's there, if it's real, the agency pulls the stigma down even further. If you have control over it, well, you might feel guilty for your shoulder because you can't go be a football player or something. But if you can go and exercise the problem away, why would you have any concern beyond let me at this exercise, you know, let me take control.
You know, where does the idea, I know the idea of stress, because I don't remember the gentleman's name. He had to study it, labels it as stress, right? But this idea of stress that we all now know and think, now that we know it's a word, we all know it's a thing now. So the idea of stress that we experience, what is its implication? And I say this because when I think about biohackers, right, I posted this thing on my Instagram where it's the Russian from Rocky IV with all the things on him, the machines clicking on him. And I'm like, okay, I'm fully biohacked now. I'm ready to take on the day, right? The worry itself about, you know, life extension, could I die tomorrow, right? I got to make sure I take these pills, these supplements, stand in the sun. I got to make sure I got to avoid Bluetooth. I got to stay away from all these things, right? And where does this point of diminished return exist where it actually affects our brain development, right? The stress on our brain. And second part to that, because you're going to rampage out on this one, is the idea of doing a mundane activity daily, right? That job we go to 40, 50 hours, which really is stamping a paper, moving something, right, that doesn't allow our brain to expand. And ready, go.
So, sorry, I got distracted and missed the first part of what you said.
The second part kind of probably threw you off talking about something mundane, but the idea of stress and how it weighs or influences our brain development,
right?
All our resources, Bill, and the point of diminished return.
So, you know, high stress affects brain development negatively, and even a stable adult brain, high stress, high cortisol, shuts down the hippocampus, shuts down learning, decreases BDNF, usually drops in hippocampal plasticity, come along with things like depression, definitely along with dull brain, poor learning, crappy sleep, et cetera. So, you know, high stress, extreme things, or chronic high levels, that's a problem. Beyond that, I'm not as concerned about stress. It's healthy. I mean, Yerkes Dodgson had that inverted U curve. You're in the middle of it. Great. A little stress is better than none. A lot of stress is worse than a little bit or a moderate amount. So I think with it comes to taking control of this and deciding, oh my God, where do I engage? You know, how do I exercise? What do I sleep? What do I eat? What do I do this? You know, it can be bewildering, and you could never accomplish everything people say you should do. And some of it's wrong, by the way. So, you know, I think you have to approach this like exercise or diet. You just can't be orthorexic about this stuff. You can't get rigid where you're like, oh my God, I didn't hit my personal record in my lift, or I'm, oh my God, I had 21 grams of carbohydrates, not 20 grams of carbohydrates, you know, or I didn't eat my carbs in that 21 minute window, whatever it was. I mean, that's orthorexia. That's like that's like the opposite of anorexia. It's the rigidity. And that itself is a problem, a significant problem that gets in the way of your life, to get back to our old definition. As long as you aren't orthorexic about that, I think you have consume information, you make informed choices, you figure out what makes sense. I mean, there's a few broad categories. You probably know you need to sleep. You probably know that sugar is not good for you. Cigarettes aren't good for you. But beyond that, there's things that may or may not be things you agree with when you dig in, or things you want to do. Like maybe you dig in, you go, okay, ketogenic diets seem to be pretty amazing for brain health, for long-term aging. But for ethical or whatever reasons, I've decided to be vegan. Well, it's really hard to do keto and vegan. They're a little bit in conflict. I have some friends that have tried. I've had some friends that didn't succeed for the most part. So maybe you'll go, okay, I don't agree with that for personal food choices. Or maybe you'll dig in and go, no, I believe in, you know, the old school food pyramid, and that's worked for me. Maybe it does work for you. Maybe you have genes that are, I mean, people are variable. Maybe eating lots of omega-6 fatty acids and wheat and corn is exactly what your body needs. Probably not for most people, you know? And so, but again, it's becoming informed, making choices, seeing how it works, being flexible enough. It's about not believing the gospel. If somebody tells you X, Y, and Z is true, and they're really, really viciously vehement about it, it may be true. It may not be. And so I think it's important to be cautious with adopting is valid. What people, you know, out there in the sort of wild west of biohacking, much isn't, unfortunately.
Yeah,
much is.
Yeah, I joked once before about trying to do it all in one day, and I wrote as many down as I could. I'm on like, it was like 45, and it was not noon yet. You know, all the things I'm supposed to do. It's like, I can't even work, man. I'd be fired, right? I'm barefoot outside. Like, I would be, if I worked at a job, it'd be over, you know.
Spending $6,000 a month on supplements. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it gets intense, man. And I think a lot of that stress, there's some point of diminished return, like, as you were discussing, in the brain development itself. And, you know, as we kind of wrap up, right, I'll end with something I maybe it does have an answer. It's where it all gets me back to, whether we're observing what the brain is doing, our behavior we're observing, we're responding to our thoughts, and our thoughts, I think, is a little presumptuous. You know, the idea of, where does a thought come from, right? Where is that? You know, are we cultivating it ourselves? This thought just appears, right? When they talk about meditation now, right? It's let the thoughts flow. It's not about quieting the mind. This is impossible, right? I mean, where is that first? I'm sorry, I'm saying consciousness, because I don't want to say that. But yeah. it's the cultural descriptive currently.
Sure. I understand what you mean when you say it. I don't believe in it, but I understand the word you're using. Yeah, consciousness. I mean, I believe in little C consciousness. I think that the moments of being aware of sensory processes, of body processes, of threats, of appetitive things like sex and food. I think that we have machinery built to be aware of that and to do a learning event and a value event. I think the capital C consciousness, the self, that the overarching thing that crosses moments, I think that's an illusion. It's a necessary illusion to make sure we keep feeding and fucking, pardon my language, but it's not necessary. I don't find any evidence for it, for big C consciousness, big C self, the spirit, the soul. I find the things that I do experience, the bound by the meat suit, to be rather magical. And the universe, in its reductionist perspective, from in my perspective, is rather magical. And the neuroscience is enough to make me bewildered and in awe without going to anything beyond what we sort of understand. So not to say that there isn't something, but I don't find the need to get beyond the idea of what consciousness is. Now, what thoughts are, Greg, that's, I think, not known. I'm not sure if it's not knowable, but I think it's not known yet. There are a couple of hints. And if you look at organization of thoughts, the hints start to come out. So long-term meditators, extremely long-term, you know, decades, have gamma waves up around 40 hertz, gamma wave connectivity throughout the cortex that seems to be somehow enhanced. And these people, I would argue that long-term meditators have a stability of that perspective, that awareness we would call consciousness. But I would, you know, subjectively, it's not your thoughts. It's that space between your thoughts that you're, you know, it's the observer of those thoughts, not the thing having the thoughts. It's almost like a formation on top, or foam on top of the self, if there is one. And then ironically, I would argue these long-term meditators have more of that stable perspective, even the less of the true sense of self. Increased gamma connectivity comes along with that. Schizophrenics who are actively schizophrenic, floridly schizophrenic, have decreased gamma connectivity throughout the cortex, especially in areas involved with perception of space and self and time and awareness and stuff like that. So maybe it's gamma coupling throughout the cortex, assembling moments of awareness. And out of that emerges processing on sensory information, awareness of body, values, judgments, drives. And that is the thoughts. Like the clouds aren't the rotation of the earth, but they're an emergent property out of the earth rotating and the wind rushing across the waves, and, you know, weather is that, but the clouds are what we see, let's say. And I think the thoughts are the thing we're seeing, but the processes rubbing against each other are producing the emergent property of thoughts as friction from the self that I don't even believe exists. So,
yeah, I dig it, man. There's been so much research, even, you know, Freud talking about the ego or these things, right? They're non-measurable. There's been no research other than a mention of this word.
Yeah, it's all theoretical. Yeah.
It's deeply theoretical. And the idea of consciousness, I mean, I would also argue too that, right, what if we're all consciously aware by our own pattern of brain functioning, experience, behavior, culture, genetic implications, right, in our own fashion, to where nobody actually becomes more conscious than another. They're just more, they just now know more, and in that knowing, believe themselves to be more conscious than, say, the next person. But like someone is better at organization because they have a neurosis, right? That's somebody that's not. This is a brain functioning, that maybe this idea of consciousness, again, is just a social construct we put together to describe someone that knows a few things other than the other person.
I think that might be true. I mean, certainly we have the ability to refine our perspective forever. You know, semantic knowledge, language learning, and meaning learning. Those things are, without a disease in the way, those things increase lifelong. Throughout the entirety of life, you have more semantic, better semantic memory lifelong. Goes up the entire life without Alzheimer's or something else in play. And even with Alzheimer's, you can not know who you are, who your kid is, who the president is. But your semantic memory, what a bed is, what this toothbrush is, that's intact and actually still continues to learn to some extent. So semantics, knowledge, is an accumulating deposit. We have no, it just builds up.
Yeah. Wow. Like, it lets go of the impertinent information anyway, right? We return to that childlike state. We need to know where to sleep, what to eat, what a fire is. But the fact that my Aunt Mary said something to me on somebody's, you know, wedding, we don't remember these finite things. It's like we let go of those and maybe return back to what real awareness is disregarding of all those constructs that develop along the way.
And we also develop a positivity bias. We attach to negative memories less, and the brain activates for negative information less and activates more for neutral and positive information the older we get. So we develop a positivity bias in what we attach to for memory. We hold those memories tighter. We observe the world with a more positive frame of mind, a framing that's, you know, makes us interpret it as if it's more interesting versus less, you know, glass half full. We do that as a brain tuning thing. As we learn more information and get more and more perspective, the brain becomes more positive. So honestly, all you have to do is keep living, keep it open, keep learning, keep stuff coming in, and eventually you will become enlightened, because that's what happens to the brain, to the mind. You know, if the only way you can fail is to give up here, right? The only way you can, you know, is to shut down, is to stop, is to protect your ego, protect what you think is true. If you're willing to have beginner's mind, you have no choice but to become enlightened. And what I would say by enlightened is not attached to your perspective of self quite so tightly.
And I love it when science backs up the cliches of, hey, you can change your life. You know,
it does. Yeah.
Couple cliches like that, and the science you're doing, and the research you're having, the guests you have on your podcast, all of these things for me are saying that you can say things like, hey, you can change your life. And it sounds cliche, but when science and what you're doing, it's backing that up. You can tune the rabbit ears. You can keep tuning them. Everything is openly possible from what we're seeing. We can shape how we think, what we think when we're aware of these things, or even unaware, we can shape those things, man. And thank you for what you're doing.
My pleasure. Nice talking to you, Adam. I look forward to seeing you in the office one of these days. We have 5 offices now, so nothing in Florida right now, but maybe we can get you over to St. Louis or Los Angeles or one of the other places. And maybe I'll see you at a biohacker conference. I do workshops and QEGs at those frequently, so maybe I'll be able to get your brain map one of these days.
Man, I'm not so sure your machine's ready for that, man.
Maybe not. We'll see if smoke pours out.
You have one of those piles where it says outlying variable, and you just put
back. Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah. You don't want someone to go, whoa, looking at your data. Yeah.
No, you. I appreciate the offer, and I certainly would love to do that one time, and maybe even help you open up an office out here. And while you're at it, before we end, tell everybody where they can find your stuff, where they can find you.
Sure. So I'm at Andrew Hill PhD on Twitter and Instagram. Peak Brain LA is the other big presence we have all over social media. We have a Peak Brain Institute Facebook. We tend to put lots of stuff out there. The Head First with Dr. Hill podcast is on YouTube and iTunes and Stitcher and things, as you mentioned, Adam. We love if people want to follow us, want to tell us their cool brain stories, ask us their brain questions. We tend to put out this free meditations on the website. We're going to start releasing more of those over the next few months. We have a dedicated mindfulness person doing some content for us, can do remote work and coaching. So, you know, I work with a lot of people who are in our offices, but also all over the world. So if you're interested in brain work, get in touch. There's always someone on the website, one of our senior people waiting for to answer your questions. So at the peakbraininstitute.com site. And, you know, get in touch. We look forward to giving you our perspective on how you can take control of your brain health and maximize your resources.
And nailed that promo, brother.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Must be the beer.
Maybe. Yeah.
I appreciate you coming on, man.
My pleasure. I'm talking to you soon, man. Take care.
Hey, buddy.
All right. Bye.